You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, August 17th, 2015. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live, steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal.
In the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA, the four-time award-winning Majority Report.
Four times.
Never forget to mention that. Those podcast awards, they come to us somehow.
Four-time award winner, man.
On today's program, Susan Dwyer, she's a professor of philosophy at the University of Maryland. She's talking about the moral naivete of ethics by numbers and biomedical research. Also, Ben Carson calls President Obama anti-Semitic. He's not even doing his fake subtlety anymore. And China's economy is about to collapse. So that's something to think about in the dog days of summer. What else we got, Matt?
We have, Bobby Jindal.
Poor Bobby.
Some hilarious.
Let me just grab it.
He's still running for president?
He's still running for president, but hilarious news from the Bobby Jindal administration and what they're trying to do to stop Confederate statues from being removed. From the great state of Louisiana.
Right.
Also, the governor of Maryland.
Right.
He's onto something here, Michael. I really think he's onto something here.
There's a conspiracy.
There's a conspiracy, and it's hurting a very already hurt class.
Very vulnerable population.
Vulnerable population. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
In Maryland. It's just, they need help.
That story is unbelievable. That story is like literally if some type of like right-wing fake news outlet was just governing the state based off of like a fake video expose, which I guess isn't all that unique.
Can you imagine that happening in this country?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can. And then, of course, on the fun half, we'll take your calls and IMs and wrap it up tight today because last time I think we went, what was it, like 2.5 hours over?
We went very long, yes.
It was incredible. But the passion. That was
Bernie Man. We'll get more into that.
Yeah, we'll get more into that later. All right, everybody, we're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Susan Dwyer.
Got your song. Here we go.
All right, everybody, we'll take a brief break. We'll be right back with Susan Dwyer.
I got a bone to pick. I don't want you monkey mouth, 'cause sitting in my throne again. Stressing. True friends. One question. Where you and I was walking. Now I run a game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta. Everybody wanna cut the legs off him. Kunta, black man taking no losses.
Oh yeah.
Where you and I was walking. Now I run a game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta. Everybody wanna cut the legs off him. When you got the yams.
What's the yams?
The yam is the power that be. You can smell it when I'm walking down the street.
Oh, yes, you can. Oh, yes, you can.
I can dig rapping. But a rapper with a ghost rider. What the f*** happened?
Oh, no.
I swore I wouldn't tell. But most of y'all share bars like you got to buy the bunk in a two-man sale.
A two-man sale.
Something's in the water.
Something's in the water.
And if I got a brown nose for some gold, then I'd rather be a bum than a mother.
Oh, yeah.
Where you and I was walking. Now I run a game, got the whole world talking.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Professor Susan Dwyer of the University of Maryland. Professor, thanks so much for joining us. How are you? Professor?
Yes, hello.
Sorry about that, Professor Dwyer. Joining us now is Professor Susan Dwyer of the University of Maryland. And we're finally here. Sorry about that technical difficulty. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. You wrote a piece for Al Jazeera America critiquing a recent piece by Steve Pinker, which I think he actually wrote for the Boston Globe. And his piece is called The Moral Imperative of Bioethics, and your piece is called The Moral Naivete of Ethics by Numbers. Before we get into your critique and Steve Pinker's argument, could you give us a kind of – I think, you know, the term bioethics, the profession of bioethicists kind of thrown around, but I don't know how many people know exactly what that job actually entails. What does it mean to be a bioethicist? What are you doing in this field?
Well, yeah, sure. So there's one thing about what the discipline of bioethics itself is, and then, as it were, what people do who are called bioethicists. Mm-hmm. So perhaps if I could start with the first.
Definitely.
But bioethics really, it was born, probably in the late 60s, early 1970s, as it were, as a freestanding discipline. And it really encompasses three different areas. The first and its initial motivation had to do with how doctors were treating their patients and what the actual interface between human beings in a medical context was. So this is where issues of informed consent, of consultation with patients, about giving patients information about their treatment, respecting their capacity to make decisions about their own treatment emerged. Mm-hmm. The second area has to do, and it's almost simultaneously, I suppose, with the birth of bioethics, was also some oversight independent of the medical and research community of medical research. So in any research involving human subjects, and especially vulnerable populations, children, prisoners, the elderly, and the mentally ill,
right.
Bioethicists were very concerned about how that research was being conducted. And the third area that we're actually seeing some real action on now around the nation has to do with public policy, and in particular about end-of-life choices that Americans will have. So those are the three sort of main dimensions of bioethics. As the field emerged, sort of autonomous aspects of bioethics generated some very new areas in ethical thinking. So, for example, about the role of narrative in human life. Mm-hmm. So often when patients are talking to their physicians about treatment, they're thinking about their treatment and the end of their own lives, for example, or their illness in the context of their own individual life. They're not just a kind of generic body. And so there's been some really interesting work there in bioethics about what we might want to call moral narrative, for example. And also there's a fabulous journal, the International Journal of Feminist Approaches to Bioethics, which has thought very, very seriously about gender issues and medicine. So that's the field of bioethics. And so with respect to what bioethicists do, they work in hospitals on teams. They work for R&D, pharmaceutical research and development companies, on institutional review boards, at any major research institution on such boards, and also play a role all the way up to the office of the president in determining policy.
Right. So basically, I mean, and you know, forgive me if this is a little bit simplified, but they're kind of there to take on the sort of qualitative questions or less kind of straight and narrow scientific questions that comes along with medical research, the moral, the ethical, potentially the legal, that are the sort of context around research. And I guess this is maybe why you sort of reacted so much to Steve Pinker's piece, and I think that people have really different feelings about this. But his argument is basically, and again, his piece that he wrote for the Boston Globe, The Moral Imperative of Bioethics, he sort of basically frames an argument that there's a tremendous amount of medical research that is sort of close at hand, about to happen, and it involves, I guess, some potentially controversial fields of research, whether it's cloning or organ regeneration. But it's right there. It's on the cusp, which I don't necessarily know if it's quite as close as he's sort of framing it to be. Could be. I'm just not entirely sure. And what's holding it back is sort of the field almost of bioethics itself. And I mean, is that basically the argument that he's positioning?
That's certainly how I read the piece.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it was troubling that he didn't, as I mentioned in the Al Jazeera essay, he doesn't cite a particular example,
right,
of where, you know, human lives are lost every day. That is an ineluctable fact of human existence. Could we be saving more lives, improving the quality of human lives? Of course we can, and I think people are hard at work at that every day. But there's no particular, it seems to me, disease or condition that bioethicists specifically have actually gotten in the way of in a way that's deeply problematic.
Right, and
that does seem to be his claim.
Yeah, that does seem to be his claim, and I think that there's two parts that you sort of connect to this right out of the gate in your essay. And first, you sort of note what you just said, which is that he doesn't cite any actual examples of research that is being kind of impeded or held up. I mean, I think the last thing that I could think of that was really in the public eye was in the Bush era. And some of the medical research that was held up then, but that wasn't sort of the result of bioethics. That was maybe more sort of Christian right politics. But then you talk about ZMapp, which is an experimental drug to treat Ebola and is not readily available to people in African nations who are dying of the disease in places like Liberia or Sierra Leone. And your point is that, you know, the reason that that's the case is a distribution question, and there's not much of the drug at hand. And the reason is because there isn't really, you know, there's not as much of a market and not as much of an incentive for pharmaceutical companies to treat the sort of lower profitability areas of dangerous infectious or, you know, airborne diseases in places like Africa. So that seems like a whole other set of questions that you're bringing up that his essay doesn't address. And it seems like it comes up a lot with these kind of, I guess you would call them one-dimensional sort of by-the-numbers arguments, which is like, okay, so there's all this realm of medical research. There's all these things that we theoretically could be doing, but we're not talking about how medicine gets distributed and why certain things are researched instead of other things and how, you know, power and development and those issues sort of come into play. So could you speak to that as well?
Absolutely. Well, ironically, Pinker does touch on this issue of what we might call the social justice of biomedical research. And he actually, in the essay, if listeners want to go read it,
yeah, it's linked to on our site.
Social justice in scare quotes, and he calls social justice along with dignity and sacredness nebulous notions. Now, I'm on the fence about sacredness, but I don't think that dignity or social justice are nebulous in the least. I think they're very concrete, concrete values. And so, ironically, he mentions social justice, but then doesn't talk about precisely what you've just mentioned. And it's true, in the Ebola case, there were several different companies who were in the business of trying to raise money and trying to conduct research on these allegedly exotic diseases that get attention only when someone from a developed nation is at risk.
Right.
That research for these kinds of infectious diseases is largely funded through the insofar as it's funded by the government, is funded through the Department of Defense under the rubric of national security, and not, in fact, having to do with actual human lives. And so, again, so thank you for raising this. One of the things that bioethicists try to do is to keep people honest about what they're doing. And to ask that very question, why are these diseases getting researched and not those diseases? Why this population, not that population? And of course, we know what we've got here is this nexus of power and money. Right. And that's what's driving a lot of research. Now, of course, that's not an indictment. I want to be clear about this. This is not an indictment of individual biomedical researchers. You know, obviously, we're dealing here with a very, very complicated system at work, a very complicated institution, a lot of different stakeholders, and asymmetries of power.
Right. And again, so, but exactly, because that how when you make it concrete and specific like you just did, there's nothing nebulous about a concept like social justice. And also you point out dignity. So, and I think it's important here because Pinker himself acknowledges that there is, you know, quote unquote, human dignity when it comes to, as an example, experimenting on human beings and experimenting on populations without you know, without their consent. So I guess I'd like you to, first of all, talk about the history of human experimentation and how, and the role that that's played in developing this field. And then secondly, talking about how it seems like dignity is another area that when the rubber kind of meets the road on these questions, it can be very simple and alluring in a kind of broad sense that he's laying out, which is like, hey, there's these amazing inventions that are around the corner that will save people's lives. And they're getting held up because of, you know, irrational and sort of, you know, philosophy department red tape, if that even makes sense. And then, you know, and then on the other hand, there's this actual history here when we did say we're just going to fast track that. And that led to things like Tuskegee, as an example, which I'd love you to talk about more. Yeah.
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on the Tuskegee case. Right. That's the case that's mentioned so often. I mean, it's so recent in American history, and it was just so egregious that that's why it's the sort of poster child for things gone wrong. But think more recently about the wonderful book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, a woman who whose tissues were used to generate really wonderful things, but absolutely without her consent and without her knowledge, as it were, she herself were merely a petri dish for growing something. And
this was a black woman who was used.
And an African-American, right. Exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so now, in fact, whenever tissue samples will be archived, as it were, you know, in informed consent documents, which, you know, I agree have gotten, they themselves have metastasized. I have served on an institutional review board at University of Maryland, and they are very, very long. But now there is a specific paragraph saying, now we are, you know, you are consenting for us to use, you know, your own material going forward in research. Those are the really egregious cases where human beings have simply been used, as philosophers like to say, as mere means for achieving certain kinds of ends. And that's what the issue is. It's very important to emphasize the mere. So bioethicists aren't opposed to human research. They aren't opposed to using human beings and human beings' tissue. It's just that we must think, we must always remember that this is the tissue of an actual human being, or this is an actual human being's body or disease, and see that in the context of their whole lives. Now, I don't know whether you've ever done any bench science, but, you know, when you do bench science and you've got some cells under a microscope, or you're growing a new protein or something like that, the only human beings you're seeing are the other people in your lab. And so I don't know that scientists and physicians, ironically, get as much training to really, really focus on the whole human person and not just on the bits of them that they're scientifically interested in. The issue about, you know, and the issue about dignity is just about that. It's about the whole human being, and making sure, as always, that you have their full consent to do whatever you're doing and that you're explaining to them what you're doing and why it's important. And that's the thing that bioethicists are concerned about. And on the issue about things going ahead without proper consultation, I think the case that that particularly interests me was the case of in vitro fertilization and the production of human embryos. As you might know, when couples undergo this treatment, often 8, 9, 10 embryos are produced. And this is a thin numbers game. These people are desperate for a child. They want to produce as many embryos as possible, so three or four at a time can be implanted, hoping that one or more will take, right? So there's a generation of embryos precisely to sort of increase the chances of a single pregnancy, and if the first time it doesn't work, you implant another three or four, however many you've generated. Now, suppose that you've made 10 embryos. Everyone knew this was possible. And suppose you're very fortunate and you implant one of those embryos and you get the pregnancy you want and you really only wanted one biological child. What happens to those other 9 embryos? No one thought through those questions when this technology was being developed. And so, for example, there was an alarming case of a couple, I believe it was in Texas, but I could be corrected on that, who divorced while they had 8 frozen embryos. And now there was a question, well, is this like my record collection? You know, do you get A through L and I get M through Z? This is not just property, records or CDs or pieces of furniture. Right. And we're still facing that question. But that was a clear case where there was research that was valuable. It was fully developed. It was implemented. People took advantage of it. And then we end up with this big moral question that intelligent people could have foreseen, but it wasn't really rigorously thought through. No protocols were in place before the technology actually took root.
Right. And before we wrap up, though, I do want to get to that question that you said you weren't necessarily on board with sacredness. So dignity, social justice, sacredness. I think that that part of the reason maybe that for some people there's some skepticism about this field is I think they might, again, we alluded to it earlier, but they might think of a guy like Leon Cass, who was President Bush's, his quote unquote, the president's philosopher, and he advised him on stem cell research. And some people seem to think that, you know, this field can be just sort of a Trojan horse essentially for religiosity and impeding like, so where do you, how do you kind of, and then in particular that terminology of sacredness, obviously religious terminology. So where do you fit with that? How do you explain that component of the field? Is that reactionary?
Yeah, sure.
Is that holding things back?
Look, I think Leon Cass's paper, the infamous paper there, The Wisdom of Repugnance, it's called, which I actually highly recommend people to read. As I describe such papers to my students, I say they are instructively flawed.
Okay.
And Cass says, look, when we have an intuitive reaction of disgust or distaste about something, and many people felt that about, for example, various kinds of reproductive technologies and still feel it.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you just trust your gut. You know, your gut is tracking the truth.
Right.
Now, no one really believes that. And the entire discipline of philosophy is premised on taking those gut instincts, those gut intuitions as your starting point. And then you say, why do I have them? Mm. Are there reasons for them? Is this just social conditioning? So that's bad bioethics. If you just say, ooh, I don't like that. Some people call it the yuck factor. It must be morally wrong. That's a crazy view, and no serious bioethicist actually thinks like that.
Right.
On the sacredness issue, I think the reason I say I'm on the fence is that I think that there are secular conceptions of sacredness.
Right.
Because when you really press on the notion of dignity and you press on what is morally valuable about human beings in the context of other human beings, in the context of the planet, many of us do feel right. There is something special there to be protected, to be valued, to be honored, to not be taken for granted. And in the end, that's really all sacredness means. It doesn't necessarily commit you to any particular religious view about the origin of the human species. It's about how we treat each other face to face in the actual lives that we lead.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And as we wrap up, I mean, I guess in some ways it seemed to me what you were trying to do and what this field is trying to do is and what Pinker, what you're responding to this sort of impulse amongst certain people to just sort of muscle the humanities out or muscle these other bigger kind of ethical and moral questions that are more difficult, they're less clear cut. But as I say, we said in the beginning, they're kind of synchronized with, and they provide a context for figuring out the right way to proceed with all of these issues, whether it's something really obvious,
yeah,
like, you know, a crime against humanity, like the Tuskegee Airmen, or something that's a lot more complicated, like what you do with, you know, in the in vitro fertilization case that you described. So is that really what you're talking about? Like this provides –
Not quite. I wouldn't put it in quite the terms that you did. I don't think that science is trying to muscle out the humanities. I think at the moment there's a reflexive defensiveness coming from the humanities disciplines, which is really unfortunate. We have nothing to apologize for. And we shouldn't even construe or allow ourselves to construe discussions like, for example, between me and Pinker about this as a fight between the humanities and the scientists. And I certainly don't think that's Steve's position. I think Steve is very, very optimistic about human nature. He's more optimistic about human beings doing the right thing for the right reasons than I am, naturally. And his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, makes that argument based on a lot of historical data. I didn't find his argument convincing. So in Pinter's case, I think it really is just being overly optimistic. And I certainly don't get the sense that scientists are saying, you know, these foolish humanists, they're stuck in the 19th century, they don't understand science. Many bioethicists actually have MDs or PhDs in physiology. I mean, it's so I wouldn't construe it in exactly that way, but I would agree with you that this is about context and about stepping back and getting that perspective where you can actually, to repeat what you said earlier, ask why this research, why now, why this population, and then think through very carefully the moral, the social, the political, and the economic implications of what you're doing. Human beings are smart enough to do that, and we should do it.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, Professor Susan Dwyer. The piece is called The Moral Naivete of Ethics by Numbers. It's at Al Jazeera. It's linked to on majority.fm. Really appreciate your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for talking with me.
Absolutely. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. All right, everybody. I wonder how that research implicates Monster Energy drinks. I wonder if that's in play.
Okay, continuing on for the show today.
I'm just trying to make a transition, man. Okay, we're going to go to the fun half, where we will take your calls at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The IMs are on. Write us a review on iTunes. I think that helps our iTunes rankings a lot, as far as I understand the iTunes rankings, which is not as well as I should understand them.
It helps for sure.
It helps for sure. It helps for sure. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Become our boss, become our partial boss, and support us for less than a cup of coffee a day. And not even less than like fancy nonsense coffee, like even less than like bodega coffee or 7-Eleven coffee or whatever other non-fancy nonsense coffee you might drink. And if you drink fancy nonsense coffee, then obviously you have enough to become a supporter of the show. So get with it.
And if you're drinking coffee, why aren't you drinking it from justcoffee.coop?
Yeah,
that's
make the trade.
Use coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% your entire order. Fair trade coffee and chocolates. I mean, can't get any better than that.
It's a win-win-win for everybody involved. Download the app. Tell people about the app, majority.fm/app. It actually really is an incredibly good app.
You can just go to majorityapp.com.
There you go. Done. Give us a review on iTunes. Become a member today. What else can people do? Oh, if you're going to buy something on Amazon, did you read that New York Times Amazon article?
I did not get around to reading it, but I've heard about it.
Well, if you haven't read that article and you're still using Amazon, you should definitely use the Amazon link when you buy something from Amazon. Definitely you want to take a little bit out of Jeff Bezos's pocket. After you read that article, although it's actually a really interesting article. We're going to be right back on the fun half of the show with your calls, your IMs, and a whole bunch more stories.
nothing I could pay.